Okay, well, thank you for coming. I work with Union of Concerned Scientists. We're a science-based public interest group. Our headquarters are in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Washington, D.C. We have several other offices, and we try to influence especially federal and sometimes state policy to support sustainable agriculture practices. We also have projects working on climate change, nuclear power, scientific integrity, and several other issues. So what I'd like to speak about today is a review work that we started to look at the potential to improve greenhouse gas or reduce greenhouse gas emissions from pasture beef production in the U.S. So just as, by way of background, why should we be interested in this? According to U.S. EPA data, about 6% of direct emissions in the U.S., global warming emissions, come from agriculture, mostly based on EPA data. By our calculations, about a third of that comes from beef production, including crop production used to feed beef cattle in feedlots. Beef production, also mostly through enteric fermentation, produces about 18% of methane emissions in the U.S., and, of course, substantial amounts of volatilized ammonia, nitrate leaching, and so on. So beef, again, production has a substantial impact on the environment. There's a growing, and another reason we need to be concerned about this is there's a growing demand for livestock products globally, is often understood. And we understand, of course, why livestock production has a fairly substantial impact in agriculture on global warming emissions, and it largely has to do with the loss of food energy as we go up the trophic scale for producing livestock products. Most projections suggest that global consumption of beef will go up modestly over the coming decades. We've had some drop in the last couple of years, probably due to increasing prices. And in particular, dairy products have been increasing fairly rapidly. This is data from FAO, annual increase data for production of dairy products from 2002 to 2007. And you can see, especially in populous countries like China and India, the U.S. and Brazil, substantial increase rates of dairy product production. In the U.S., most beef is finished in feedlots where they're fed grain concentrates that are based mainly on corn. So another question would be, why should we be concerned about pasture or grazing land production? And as this figure shows, and as we know with ruminants, they do need to get a substantial portion of their diet from forages. This data represents time along the x-axis. And the magenta and tan bars are time, mostly often in cow-calf operations on range or pasture, and the blue sections are time in feedlots. So just as a reminder that, you know, even when we use CAFO systems, we still have to be mindful about grazing systems. So this is kind of a complicated summary of data, but I'll just walk you through some of the points that I want to make here. The third column is data on methane reduction in the literature based on improved or best management practices compared to commonly used practices. And here's a standard practice and a methane reduction practice. So, you know, a couple things to note that, you know, are clear that some species of pasture crops have a lower are responsible for lower methane emissions. In this case, birdfoot trefoil, which is a leguminous pasture crop, and again compared to high quality ryegrass. In this study by Woodward and Waghorn, showed about a 32% reduction in methane emissions. And again, this is mostly enteric methane, of course. One point that I want to make a couple times in this talk is the importance of complementing the phenology of different pasture crops and taking advantage of the phenology of pasture crops that's favorable in terms of climate change emissions. And in these boxes here, in these rows, Are examples of comparisons between rapidly growing pasture crops versus mature pasture crops, and the difference in methane emissions for the methane emissions decreased with faster, more rapidly growing crop growth, and this is usually due to more leaf area, less lignin in the and more soluble or easily digestible carbohydrates in the more rapidly growing crops. Another important point, this is cut off on the bottom, but it's still fine, is the value of high-quality harvested forages, and I'll get back to why I think that is an important issue as well. Moving on to nitrogen loss, we know pretty well what the factors are that contribute to loss of nitrogen from pasture. And so, targeting these, we can consider how we might improve that. One issue is manure deposition on dormant pasture. Most, pastures, probably all pastures in the U.S. have dormant periods where pasture crops reach maturity. And, of course, because they're growing slower, they have low nitrogen use efficiency, reduced ability to absorb nitrogen deposited in manure. Again, I want to get back to this issue of crop phenology and nitrogen use efficiency. Studies on different pasture grasses have shown variable ability or variable levels of nitrogen use efficiency. For example, in several studies comparing orchard grass to smooth brome grass, both fairly common pasture species in a number of parts of the U.S., these studies, one of them included Kentucky bluegrass as well, found that orchard grass had nitrogen use efficiency values of anywhere from about 12 to about 45% higher than the other species, and this was attributed largely to longer active growing periods for orchard grass compared to the other species. We can also improve nitrogen use efficiency through complementing the active growing period of either mixtures or applications of different pasture species. So just as an example, in a study by Sauer et al., they overseeded orchard grass with ryegrass and winter rye, and measured nitrous oxide emissions over time. This is cumulative nitrous oxide over the year. And I think the take-home point here is that in Figure A, which was for 2001, Figure B for 2000, Column 2 shows nitrous oxide emissions for rye with poultry litter added as a nitrogen source, the rye overseeded on the orchard grass. Column 4 is data for the orchard grass without overseeded rye with the added poultry litter. And at least in these experiments, especially in this year, there were substantial reductions in cumulative nitrous oxide emissions. Again, probably due largely to the complementation of the rapidly growing ryegrass during the mature stage of the orchard grass. And I want to finish with a focus on a parameter that I think is of particular importance, and that's the feed efficiency or forage efficiency. High feed efficiency reduces both methane emissions and nitrous oxide emissions for a couple reasons. One, of course, is that the animals put on weight faster, so they reach either slaughter stage or milk production faster, and therefore there's less time to produce global emission gases. And as well, because the efficiency of utilization of higher feed efficiency crops is higher, more of the crop is used by the animal to produce product rather than going on to methane production or nitrogen that can be lost to the system. Okay. Yeah, we already covered that. And so I just want to end, again, it's a complicated table, but I think I can walk you through part of it just to give a sense of where I think some of the opportunities lie. So I want to start with as kind of a baseline study that's been widely cited by Peltier et al. Comparing climate change emissions from CAFOs and pasture-finished beef production. And the way we measured the quality or efficiency of the forages here, or the feed, in the case of CAFOs, is by average daily gain values, which is an integrated value of efficiency. And they had typical values here. This is for Iowa of about 1 point. So the units here are 1 point. Weight gain per day, in this case 1.4 kilograms per day for the corn-based concentrate in a feedlot. That's a pretty typical value. The value they used based on the Iowa data that they had available for forage was about 0.6 kilograms per day. So the ratio for efficiency of the forage to the concentrate, and concentrate is usually kind of considered a gold standard because corn is a very efficient feed, was about 0.43. But if we look at some of the other possibilities in the literature, again, the issue of quality of the pasture makes a big difference, and again, in terms of the phenology of the crops. So a study by Hart et al., a recent study, showed that high-quality ryegrass could give average daily gain values comparable to that of feedlot, but the low-quality mature ryegrass had values of only 0.37, or only about a quarter of the value of the rapidly growing ryegrass. So again, the phenology of the crop is critically important. In a study, again, overseeding southern grasses this time, perennial grasses with annual ryegrass, this was by Duramis in 2003. They also used managed rotational grazing in the study. Again, the average daily gain values of 1.26 kilograms per day, about 93% of the feedlot value. Let's skip that. And again, it's important to consider that, you know, in most parts of the world, and certainly in temperate areas, we have periods of time where pasture is dormant or mature and or dormant. And as I tried to illustrate, there's a number of problems with both the pasture and the crop in terms of its climate impacts at that stage. So one potential solution, especially in integrated systems, is to supplement the feed or the forage with harvested forages, high-quality harvested forages during those times when pastures are dormant. And these are some of the average daily gain values from high-quality pasture. They tend to be about 1 kilogram per day to about 1.2 kilograms per day. This is, by comparison, CAFO values, so that's concentrate. So it's these values here, here, and here. And in summary, if you look at this bottom oval, if you take all of these average values, this is includes the low values, we come out with an average daily gain value of about 1 kilogram per day. In comparison, again, to the 0.6 that was used in the Peltier study by comparison, so about 76% of the value found in CAFOs compared to about 44% found in the Peltier study. So we think there's quite a bit of opportunity for increase. These are, you know, mostly not uncommon practices. We need a lot more data to understand how commonly used these different pasture practices are. There's very little data on this, and it's, I think, an important thing we need to understand better. But these are available practices and have a lot of potential to increase the efficiency of forages. So just in conclusion, we think there's a lot of available practices, if we have a better understanding of them, that can decrease climate change emissions in pastures. Not a lot of work has been done to try to understand these, understand where they're being used, where they're not being used, what are the barriers to implementation, and so on. But to the extent that we can get a better handle on the potential of these, we also need to consider ways of incentivizing best management practice, for example, through the EQIP program and the conservation title of the Farm Bill. We need to also allocate more resources in improving pasture species. This has been a highly under-researched area, and there's tremendous genetic variability in pasture crops. We think so that is certainly an opportunity if we put more resources into improving pasture forages for virtually all of the properties I talked about, for example, improving nitrogen use efficiency, yield, geographic range of useful species, trying to extend the range of active growth periods, and better understanding mixtures in terms of their value. Next steps, I think we need to get a better understanding of the quantitative value of some of the potential of especially increased forage efficiency. So running some of these values as a sensitivity analysis through climate models such as DASEN, I think, would be of great value. Thank you. Well, I mean, in the last farm bill, there was some division in resource allocation that included feedlots, and it's a difficult question. I mean, I think you know, there is opportunities in feedlots to reduce environmental impacts, and that's of some value. But I think we also need to make sure there's kind of a line item or practices such as these, you know, included in the farm bill. So. I mean, we tend to favor, you know, pushing towards more sustainable practices. So we'd like to see more money. But in the reality of these, you know, the current budget discussions, there'll probably be reductions all around. So we want to make sure that these practices are included, whether the practices for CAFOs are continued or not.
Any other questions?
No, and that would obviously be important to do. We were, you know, at this phase, we were really just looking at, you know, the potential impacts. excuse me. We do have two economists on our team, and one of the things I'd like to do with them is a next step is to look at some of the economic questions related to these practices.